Everybody this morning. Glad you're here. What a time we're going to have today looking into God's Word. In American athletics, it's considered unsportsmanlike to run up the score on an opponent after the outcome of a game is already decided. In fact, today, there are rules in most youth sports leagues against running up the score. Still, it has happened. The winning team will keep on trying to score points against a hapless opponent when there's no question as to who's going to win and who's going to lose the game. Case in point. About a century ago, back in 1916, Georgia Tech defeated the Cumberland College Bulldogs 222-0. By quarters, Georgia Tech scored 63, 63, 54, and 42 points. You can laugh if you want. And then they backed off in the second half. Neither team in this game scored a first down. No team gained a first down because Georgia Tech scored on every series of downs and the Cumberland College never got a first down. They punted on the fourth down every time. But it's not just a century ago when this happened. A few more. In 1985, the University of Miami Hurricanes were playing Notre Dame. Under coach Jimmy Johnson, the Hurricanes, late in the fourth quarter, it was fourth and long, fourth and 11. They used a fake punt, got their first down. They already had a lead of 44-7 and went on to win 58-7. Here's a good one. November 23rd, 1968, the University of Houston defeated the University of Tulsa 100-6. They led 24 at the half and then scored 11 touchdowns in the second half. That's running up the score. But my favorite is the Ohio State Buckeyes under coach Woody Hayes. They were playing their bitter arch rival, the Michigan Wolverines. Sorry, Harry. Sorry about that. In that year, Ohio State was on its way to a national championship, and Ohio State had just scored its last touchdown. They were up 50-14 late in the fourth quarter, and Coach Hayes said, "We're going to go for two." So they didn't just try the one-point kick. They tried for a two-point conversion, which was unsuccessful. After the game, Coach Hayes was asked, "So why did you go for two?" "Because I couldn't go for three." Yes. Thank you, Coach. Now, all those stories have their sad side and their kind of funny side, but they draw us to the idea that you shouldn't kick somebody when they're down. You shouldn't take unfair advantage. It's just wrong to run up the score. And I'm warning you at the outset this morning that it may seem to you that I am running up the score on our good friend Job. He's down, and I'm kicking him. Today, we're turning from a two-week focus on Job's friends. And now we're looking at Job himself. His speeches give us a glimpse into what's going on inside, in his soul. As his trials become more chronic, and especially in light of his friends' feedback. And sadly, the view we get of what's going on inside Job is not all that pretty. Last week, we paid a lot of attention to the cruel way in which Job's friends treated him. Today, we're going to get a front row seat and look at how Job treated his friends. I believe we're going to learn something important today, something that is very important when it comes to Christian discipleship. But it's one of those tough lessons. Today is a lesson in extreme Christian discipleship. And that's the kind of discipleship to which we're all called. But on a purely practical level, I'll say honestly that today's message and next Sunday's sermon, for me, are the most challenging of all that we see in Job's story. And I won't be surprised if it is the same for you as well. Now, we've been in the story of Job for several weeks. Just to recap for a minute some of what we've seen, Job lived in about 2000 BC, about 4,000 years ago. He was a godly and wealthy man. He had a large and happy family. One day, he lost all of it, all of his possessions, his 10 children. And then shortly after that, on another day, he lost his health. It wasn't because Job had done something wrong that all this trouble came on him. That's what his friends thought. They were mistaken. It was precisely because God wanted to show Satan that Job will continue to love me and trust me and follow me, even if all of my blessings are taken away from him. Job had always been God's representative. He had been God's man among men. He'd been a bright light in dark places. Now's the test. Will he continue to be that kind of a man when hardship hits? And just kind of as a timeout, that is always been the call of God on the people of God, that we are to be God's representatives here on earth. We're to be God's people, shining like bright lights in a dark world. And the darker the world gets, the brighter we shine. No matter what, be on mission for Jesus' great commission, even in the midst of hardship and pain and all the rest. Satan said Job would blow it. He'd fail. God said, no, he won't. He'll succeed. He'll keep on keeping on. And so far, what we've seen is just an incredible display of faith and integrity from Job. After his losses, this is what he said. Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall return there. The Lord gave. The Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And we say, way to go, Job. Just tremendous victory. After he lost his health, his wife gave him counsel. Just let it get this over with. Curse God and die. To which Job responded, shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? Another win for God and Job. Job's doing great. Satan loses again. Job then retreated to the city's trash dump. That's where people went in the ancient world to live when they had communicable diseases so as to protect the rest of the community from getting sick. And while he was there sitting on the ashes with his three good friends around him, he poured out a desperate lament for how bad his life was going, for how horrible things were for him. And that lament was a perfectly legitimate, perfectly appropriate way to respond to his grief and his loss and his sufferings. He's three for three. He's batting 1,000. Just doing great. Then, after sitting on the ashes for 7 days and seven nights, after pouring out his lament, his friends start to speak. And the first of those friends to speak is Eliphaz. He's the leader of the gang. He's probably the oldest. And this is what Eliphaz says to his diseased, grieving, tortured soul friend, Job. Remember now, Job, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the upright destroyed, like you're being destroyed? According to what I've seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble, they're the ones who harvest trouble. In other words, Eliphaz lays the blame for Job's suffering on Job. Sorry, buddy, you've brought this all on yourself. Listen to what Job says next. What he responds, and his response is very compelling. It's transparent, it's honest, it's childlike. Chapter 16, verse 4. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend. And that's just Job. He's expressing his longing. What he wants from his friends is kindness, compassion, comfort. And I picture Job sort of in shock after this tongue lashing he's gotten from Eliphaz. In my mind's eye, I picture him just reeling as if he's just been slapped by a good friend for no reason. And his comeback to Eliphaz is sort of along the lines of, hey man, try a little tenderness here. Be easy on me. Look at what I'm going through. And God hasn't been left out of this equation either. The downstream transcendent reason why a friend should be so kind to a suffering friend is so that he will not forsake the fear of the Almighty. Now, it's a very good thing when friends come alongside suffering friends and offer kindness. It's not a bad thing when a suffering friend expresses a longing for that kindness. And it's not a bad thing either when a suffering friend doesn't receive that kindness if the suffering friend expresses disappointment. And that's what Job does. Verse 15. My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish. Now a wadi, we don't usually use this term in Texas, but a wadi, we're very familiar with wadis. It's an occasional stream. Occasionally it flows and occasionally it doesn't. And at most times of the year in most places, the stream beds in Texas are dry. And then they occasionally flow with water. That's a wadi. When they become waterless, they're silent. When it's hot, the one time you'd really like for it to be flowing, they vanish from their place. The paths of their course wind along. They go up into nothing and perish. One of my favorite places to camp and backpack in recent years has become Big Bend Ranch State Park. It's way out in West Texas in the desert. Out there it's dry. You'd expect it to be dry there. But there are oases out there. And once you find the watering holes, it can be really delightful. There's nothing better when you're on a backpacking trip than to be hiking along in a dry riverbed and then to come along a spot where the water bubbles up from underground and it pools up. Because that's where you stop, that's where you take a break, that's where you fill up your water bottles, that's where you maybe climb up on the bank under a cottonwood tree and pitch your tent and spend the night. And then sure enough, 30 yards downstream, the water disappears and it flows underground again. You don't see it anymore. That's a wadi. It's unpredictable and it's undependable. And that's exactly the way Eliphaz's words have impacted Job. His parched soul was really, really longing for some nice, cool water. And what Eliphaz gave him was dry, dusty words. Didn't help at all. Job is hurt. He's disappointed. His longing for compassion and comfort has just been crushed. And he laments that disappointment. It's not bad to lament that disappointment. He continues to speak, though, and he expresses hope. I find this to be really compelling on Job's part. It takes courage to hope, and he's voicing his desire for some friendliness from his friends. Teach me now, and I'll be silent. Verse 24. Show me how I've erred. See, there's openness. Job isn't closed off to what his friends have to say. He's willing to learn. Amen. Just, if I'm off base here, just let me know and direct me back into the right path. I'm listening, but your words are, they may be honest, but they're so painful. And what does your argument prove anyway? I'm in pain. Can't you help me? After all, I'm innocent. I don't think Job is claiming perfect innocence, but he hasn't done anything in his mind to deserve the kinds of trouble that's come his way. Look at me. See if I lie to your face. Desist now. Let there be no injustice. Even desist. My righteousness is yet in it. Now, to this point, what I believe Job is doing is expressing the desire of his heart for comfort and compassion. He's listened to the speech of Eliphaz. He's listened to the speech of Bildad. And then Zophar speaks. Zophar is the least diplomatic. He's the most insulting of Job's three friends. And this is what Zophar says. These are some of his less than gracious words. Chapter 11, verse 2. Shall a multitude of words go unanswered, and a talkative man be acquitted? In other words, Job, you're just flapping your gums. Quit, just talk, talk, talk. That's all you do. Or this, verse 12. An idiot will become intelligent, and he's talking to Job here. An idiot will become intelligent when the foal of a wild donkey has borne a man. Thank you, Zophar. That's very insulting. And there's a change in the tone of Job's response now. Job starts to get sarcastic. Oh, truly then, you're the people, and with you, wisdom will die. But I have intelligence as well as you. I am not inferior to you, and who doesn't know such things as these? Hey, your insights aren't all that insightful, Zophar. And he goes on to say, hey, ask the beasts of the field, ask the birds of the sky, ask the fish of the sea. They all know what you're saying. What you're saying isn't helpful at all. I'm not insignificant. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you. It's not only nothing new, it's nothing helpful. Listen to Job's words carefully here. There's a sharp edge to it. See if you don't hear something a little bit different. Verse 4 of chapter 13. You smear with lies, you are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be completely silent, and that it, that is, oh, that your silence would become your wisdom. Your memorable sayings are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. Be silent before me so that I may speak. Then let come on me what may. And that's the end of the first round of speeches. There's three rounds of speeches. This is the conclusion of the first round. And Job is hurt. He's just astounded. These are my good friends, and they're piling it all back on me. They're saying that I'm responsible for my own sufferings. He's pleaded with them for compassion, and all he's gotten are explanations and accusations. I hope that you never find yourself surrounded at a time of grief and loss by the 21st century version of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They're still out there. You and I have been around suffering people enough to know that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are always lurking around. They're always looking for someone to help. Always willing to give an explanation for why you're suffering or make an accusation. If you ever sense that you are in their sights, run away. Just run away. If you're in a place of suffering and grief and loss, you don't need Eliphaz around. You don't need to listen to Bildad and Zophar. We feel for Job right now. His friend's failure to help at his time of need has actually made his sufferings worse. Life would have been way easier if they had just given him the compassion he was wanting. But now, Job has to deal with their insensitivity as well as on top of his own loss of children and health and wealth and all the rest. But now he's more than disappointed. Job turns angry. He is disgusted. It was, I want. Now it is, you should. You better come through for me. What started off as a perfectly legitimate longing has morphed into something very ugly. Now he requires that his friends come through for him. And from this point forward, getting his friends to respond to his pain the way he wants them to becomes his obsession. The second speech of Eliphaz is fascinating. I hope that you take sometime in the next few days to read Eliphaz's second speech, chapter 15 of Job. It's a masterpiece of insensitivity. Eliphaz accuses Job of being a windbag. Says, you speak nonsense, you speak irreverence, you're a fool for not listening to my wisdom, you're ridiculous for thinking you're the only wise person around here. And then Job responds to that. Oh, I've heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to the windy words you have to say? What plagues you that you answer? What pressure do you feel inside that makes you just want to have to say something? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. And the message is crystal clear. You've let me down. You have not come through for me. And it's more than that. Job goes on to say, if our roles were reversed, if I was in your place, I would not do to you what you have done to me. I would come through for you. Listen to this. I could strengthen you with my mouth. The solace of my lips could lessen your pain. But you haven't helped at all. You're a bunch of fools. I don't find a wise man among you. And he continues. And as he continues, there is sort of a rising, there's a crescendo of bravado, baggage, defensiveness, however you want to put it. How long will you torment me? See, it started off with a sincere disappointment over not receiving help and compassion. Now, you have harmed me. How long will you torment me and crush me with words? These 10 times you've insulted me. You're not ashamed to wrong me. And then among the last things that Job has to say in this second round of speeches, if you want to just summarize it, it's be quiet. Just stop. Verse 5, look at me, be astonished, put your hand over your mouth. They are sorry comforters. They haven't done any good at all. He's sick and tired of listening to them. And we somehow feel in our gut that he is absolutely right and he is justified for speaking in the way that he does to his friends. There's been lots and lots of times I've read through the speeches of Job and I've sort of been, in my mind's eye, I've been clapping, saying, way to go, Job. Just give it to those false friends. Let them have it. Both barrels. The intensity of the speeches does not subside in the third round. It intensifies. Because as Eliphaz starts his third speech, he crosses a line. It's not hard to see. It's a very clear line. He does something terrible. He accuses Job of terrible sins. You have never once lifted your finger to help a widow or an orphan. You have never given food to people who are hungry. You have denied justice to the weak. You have abused the helpless, Job. It's all lies. That's completely contrary to what we know of the kind of man Job was and the kind of life he lived. And that's Eliphaz's speech, his last speech to Job. And that's what pushes Job over the edge. Now his friends aren't friends anymore. Now they're enemies. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar are his sworn enemies. And these are the words he says in chapter 26. Oh, what a help you are to the weak. How you have saved the arm without strength. What counsel you have given to one without wisdom. What helpful insight you have abundantly provided. It's dripping with sarcasm. To whom have you uttered these words? Guys, who do you think you're talking to? Do you remember? It's me. It's Job. You've known me your whole lives. And then this last phrase. Whose spirit was expressed through you? I think that is Job saying that the animating spirit, the source of their words against him, is Satan, the accuser. That's whose spirit was expressed through them. You can hear his scorn. If we had time, we would look at chapter 27. What we would see is that his anger bleeds through every word. More rage, more fury. And Job, upright and blameless, fearing God, turning away from evil, adopts the same method, the same tactics as his enemies, his friends, and he threatens them with God's judgment for the way they've treated him. Now, you and I know the backstory. We know the first and second chapters of Job. We know about the heavenly wager between God and Satan. We know what's really going on. Job doesn't. And we who know the backstory are increasingly uneasy as we listen to Job. Because we're aware that the way he's speaking now is contrary to the character of the man we knew him to be at the very beginning of the story. And we wonder, is Satan in the background? He's rubbing his hands. Got him now. I got another one. He's mine now. I'm going to win this thing. I got Joe right where I want him. Because the reality is that while, yes, Eliphaz did cross a line, Job crossed a line too. And Job lost sight of his calling by God to worship to love, to be God's representative. So, what have we seen? We've seen a suffering man who's lost everything. Longs for the comfort of friends. He's denied that comfort and compassion he so longs for, and so he begs for it. And after begging for it, he is still denied the comfort and the love and the compassion that he longs for, and his longing then morphs into something ugly. And Job becomes what he never was before, or if he was, it was latent. He becomes a man who doesn't just desire, he requires his friends to come through for him. Job is no longer the God-centered, others-focused man who loves and serves and trusts. Job has become an ugly demander. And we have now run up the score on Job. We have piled on. We have become Ohio State coach Woody Hayes, who goes for a 2-point conversion against a hopelessly defeated Job because, well, we couldn't go for three. Or is that who we are? Is it okay, is it legitimate to find fault with Job for how he behaved in pain? Or is he exempt from evaluation because he's in pain? Let's imagine something for just a minute. Let's just imagine that it's in the middle of a worship service. You don't have to imagine that because we are in the middle of a worship service, but imagine some other worship service. I'm maybe in the middle of delivering a message or someone's giving a moment's remission. And then right in the middle of that, somebody stands up. They scream. They knock over chairs. They upset a row or two of chairs and bump into people on their way out. They crash through the double doors and noisily enter the foyer. That guy made a shambles of our worship service. Whatever edifying was going on certainly has been shot to pieces. And if that happened, we'd think poorly of that man. He's rude. He's insensitive. What would happen to your thinking if you found out he just had an acute attack of appendicitis? What was happening was he just was in the middle of passing a kidney stone when he stood up, screamed, and ran out of the room to get to the bathroom as quick as he could. Oh, that changes everything. He's in pain. That changes our expectations of someone. All kinds of behavior, odd, unusual, weird, whatever, are completely excused when we're in pain. Right? So is Job excused from a life of worship and love and being God's man? Is he exempt from that because he's in pain? Am I? When I'm in pain, when I'm disappointed, when I've suffered loss, am I exempted from being on mission for Jesus' Great Commission? Are you? Be good to know. Among my favorite reading material is Voice of the Martyrs magazine and website. And one of the reasons I enjoy so much being exposed to that material is because our brothers and sisters, believers in Jesus around the world who face persecution, often, not perfectly, but they often rise from persecution, dust themselves off, and then look for their next opportunity to talk about Jesus. It's not, well, I don't have to now because I'm in pain. It's, let me at him. Let me back in the game. The more personal and more intimate our relationships, the higher our expectations and hopes, and the more keenly we feel disappointment. So you've got a good friend. And this good friend doesn't appreciate you, forgot your birthday, did you dirty, said something wrong, and it hurts. If you're married, our expectations for our husband, our wife, are naturally higher for finding comfort and compassion and help. When we are let down at home, and this could be with husbands, wives, this could be with parents, children, this could be with friends, are we therefore exempt from loving and worshiping and free to become angry and demanding and pout and rage? If Job is our example, the answer is yes. Because when his friends let him down, slammed his fist on the table, and demanded, he required that his friends come through for him. And the good news is, Job is not our example. Job lost sight of his calling, but there is one who did not. There's one man who never forgot his calling from God. And here at the end, we look to Jesus. Jesus is the gold standard for God-centered, others-focused living. And you look at Jesus at a number of points during his life when he was in pain. And you watch how he stayed on course. Kept on loving, kept on worshiping, kept on serving God's purposes. Watch him as he walks from northern Galilee down to Jerusalem. This is the last time he walks to Jerusalem. He's on his way to die. The cross is looming large. He would really have benefited from some compassion and understanding from his 12 friends, the disciples. What did he get? James and John separated themselves from the other 10, walked up and talked to Jesus and said, "Hey, in your coming kingdom, we want to sit one on your left and one on your right side, okay? The other 10 be hanged." Jesus looked right past his own desire for comfort and gathered them all together and had one more talk about the importance of servanthood. Come on, guys. Remember. Watch Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. He is arrested by the Roman guards, by Jewish priests, and his disciples are all right there with him. Would he have loved for his disciples to hang with him, to offer him support, to endure hardship with him? Yes. And he saw how frightened they were. He asked that they be protected as they ran off into the night. Jesus kept the course alone. Watch him on the next day on the cross. He's dying. He's nailed to the cross for you and me. And he looked beyond his pain, and his pain was absolute. Physical, emotional, spiritual. He looked beyond all that and he spoke words of forgiveness to a penitent thief. He spoke words of love and care for his mother. Spoke words of salvation to a lost world. That's what Jesus does when he's in pain. Kept on entrusting himself to his Father. And that's our calling. Hope for comfort, long for compassion, but never require it. It's one of the hardest lessons in Christian discipleship out there. Speaking quite personally, it's one of the hardest lessons out there. Longing is good. Desiring is human and good. Hoping is courageous and good. Demanding is bad. Demanding is death. There is more going on in your pain and in your disappointment than your pain and disappointment. Who knows? Maybe in heaven, God is saying to Satan, "There's no way she's going to turn away now. She's going to keep on walking with me. He's going to keep on trusting. And you keep on entrusting yourself to God. There's the victory. You keep on loving, keep on trusting, keep on worshiping. Stay on mission for Jesus' great commission. And what does Romans say? We will crush Satan's head under our feet. Feels good, doesn't it? Let me ask if you would please stand with me. I'd like for us to close in prayer together. Father, thank you so much for the example of Jesus. We want very, very much, Lord, to be your men, your women, young people who keep on keeping on despite pain. You are exceptionally glorified, we sense, when we trust you when it's hard, when it's difficult. And so for all of us who are going through difficult times right now, give us the grace to look to you now. May we be like Jesus, entrusting ourselves to you, our faithful, trustworthy God. May we win the victory over our enemy so that you get all the glory. We ask all this in the mighty name of Jesus. We all said together, amen. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you all.